This is Cityscape. I'm Steve Potter. Musician, singer, songwriter, and producer Nick Lowe has had quite the storied career. He got his start playing in London's pub rock scene in the early 1970s, and by the mid-1970s was a highly regarded producer working with Elvis Costello on his first five albums, and a member of the band Rockpile, though he's always been a notable solo artist and songwriter. Some of his best-known tunes include What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, Cruel to Be Kind, and I Love the Sound of Breaking Glass. He's currently on a solo acoustic tour and will make a stop at the Sheldon Concert Hall next Wednesday night. St. Louis Public Radio's Mike Schran talked to Lowe about his career and his thoughts on songwriting.
What role did music play in your childhood, and at what age did the music bug bite you?
Well, I was bitten pretty early by the music bug because of my mom. She was very musical. She was a pretty good singer. And in fact, she taught me to play the guitar. In fact, I say taught me to play the guitar. She taught me the two or three chords that she knew. And they were ukulele chords, but they work on a guitar too. She first got me interested, and she had some pretty good records in her collection, the sort of things that most people had back then, I suppose. Good singers, Sinatra and Nat King Cole, and a lot of show music as well. She also had, rather strangely, in her collection, a record by a fellow called Tennessee Ernie Ford, who's had one massive hit in the UK called 16 Tons. And anyway, she had a couple of 10-inch albums by him, and that was the first time I heard any kind of country and western music, and I really, really liked that.
Did you ever imagine doing anything other than being a musician?
I had a couple of jobs after I left school. I wanted to be a journalist, actually. That was if I couldn't be a musician, you know, I thought, well, I'd like to be a journalist. But I wanted to be a sort of war reporter. And the only job I could get was on the local paper, going around and, you know, interviewing the, you know, some local city official about something. It wasn't really what I had in mind.
Right.
I wanted something a bit more glamorous than that. And also, I didn't have what it took. You know, you have to be a special kind of person to be good at that, yeah, at that work. And I didn't really have it. And there wasn't really a music business back then. It was just a branch of show business. It was seen to be a really bad idea to go into it. And when the Beatles came along and all that business started happening, it was too exciting, you know, and it changed everything. And then suddenly I got an opportunity to join a school friend's band. He had a record deal, which everybody did, had a record deal back then. But I didn't care, you know, I left home when I was 18 to join the band, and that was it. That was 1968.
You were part of the pub rock scene in, what, the late 60s and early 70s in London?
Yes, I think that's fair enough to say. About early 70s, really.
What was the music scene like in the late 60s and early 70s in London?
The thing that precipitated the pub rock scene was, they tried to get it going in other cities in the UK, but it didn't really work. It was a London phenomenon, really. And it was a reaction against what I and my colleagues and a lot of sort of hipsters, you know, we thought we were all quite hip. You know, we thought the music business had got very bloated, and the big musicians were taking themselves very seriously, which we thought was quite ridiculous, and getting rather detached from their audience. And the hippie thing hadn't helped, you know, where the musicians were given this almost godlike status, you know, in a lot of cases. And we thought this needed readdressing. So a little movement started off in the pubs in London where bands would play, and they'd be like jukeboxes, really. It was free to get in, and the bands would play a real mixture of music. It was a real breaking down of the way it had got structured. Mm-hmm. And it paved the way, really, for the punk music thing, which was much more, obviously, had a much bigger sort of international reach, and as well as being countrywide. And I was involved with that in that I produced quite a lot of those records from that era.
So tell me about how you got your start as a producer.
When the band I was in, the Brinsley Schwartz, we never made it, so the time came for us to break up. And I fell in with some other people from the pub rock scene, and they started a record label called Stiff Records, and I became the house producer just because I had more experience in the studio than the other fellows involved in it. And also I thought I knew how it should go, and I thought I had my finger on the pulse, and I was good at telling people what to do, you know, without them, you know, putting their backs up. And we had some success. Had a few hits, quite a lot of misses, but we had some hits as well. And so I sort of fell into it, really.
And so Graham Parker and Elvis Costello would be two of the artists that, I guess, kind of gave you your name as a producer?
Yeah, yes, definitely.
How did that experience affect your ability to write your own material? Did it change your writing in any way?
I was always writing stuff, and I had a sort of parallel career as a solo artist, and also a sort of songwriter for hire as well. People back then would commission me to write songs. I had my finger in a few branches of show business, and then I formed a group with a guy called Dave Edmonds. So we formed a group called Rockpile, and that's when I first started coming to the United States on a regular basis, and things started to happen for me over here.
Your nickname as a producer was the Basher. How did you get that nickname?
I was quoted once as saying, when asked about my production style, I said, well, what I do is I get them to bash it down, and then we tart it up later. In other words, get the groove down. You know, if you get a really nice groove down, it doesn't matter if there's mistakes in it, because we can fix them. I became known for that. But in fact, it came from somewhere else originally, but I think it'd be too difficult to explain to you what it was. So we'll just leave it at the popular version.
Fair enough. But it seems that your aesthetic as a musician and producer is pretty straightforward. Has this always been the way you've done things?
I had a little look at prog rock, you know, for over a weekend once in 1968, and I realized it just wasn't for me. You know, I've always liked music which is not earnest. You know, earnestness, I think, is the real big enemy of being able to do something which is really good. I'm always eager to make it as straightforward as I can. I think songwriting really is a sort of dying craft now. I think of it somehow as being akin to knowing how to make a thatched roof or build a stone, a dry stone wall or one of those sort of things. People don't really need anymore, you know, but they like, you know. And I think songwriting is one of those things. I think it'll probably have died out completely in, you know, 20 or 30 years.
Can you describe in general your process of how you write songs? Do they come quickly, or do you have to spend a lot of time crafting them?
Well, I do spend quite a lot of time crafting them, yes. But in order to make them sound like you haven't spent any time at all, that's the real trick. I sort of work away at them. If I've got a good idea, an idea which I think is a good thing, I work away at it. When I'm just doing my day-to-day chores, you know, driving my car, doing the shopping, you know, I can work away at it. And I go into a sort of a trance, I suppose, and I work away at the thing and sing it over in my mind until, in a way, I suddenly think I'm singing somebody else's song. I've got it. I'm singing a cover song. And that's when I believe that it's finished. I can sing it as if I was singing a real standard.
Is that part of the process of removing the earnestness?
I suppose it is, yeah, yes, because you don't want it to be too clever. You know, I can't stand seeing my little tricks and things, you know. That I've got a theory about writing songs, which I could tell you quickly if you would like to hear it.
Please.
My latest thing is that it's rather like if you're in an apartment with a rather thin wall. The apartment next door is tuned permanently to a really cool radio station. It's on all day, and you can hear it sort of playing through the wall, you know, just burbling away. And then one day, the radio station starts to program this really fantastic new song, and you start to hear it coming through the wall. And each time it comes on, you stop what you're doing and you kind of almost, you know, get a wine glass out, you know, put it up against the wall, because you want to learn this song, this cool new song that they've programmed. And every time it comes on, you learn a little bit more. There's, you know, you learn the first verse slowly, you know, and then the chorus, you work the way of the chorus. And you never know when they're going to play this tune. It could be any time of the day or the night even, you know. But every time it comes on, you sort of stiffen, you know, and receive a little bit more until finally the day comes when you've actually learned this song.
One last question. I had the pleasure of seeing you open for and play an encore set with Wilco when you visited St. Louis around this time last year. And I've recently read an article where Alex Turner of Arctic Monkeys has extolled the virtues of your songwriting and your work. Do you ever give much thought to the influence that you've had on other songwriters?
I don't really. I'm always rather surprised when I hear. I mean, I knew that Alex had said these nice things about me, and he's died on more than one occasion, and I'm extremely I'm thrilled about it, you know. But I must say, I'm always quite surprised whenever it crops up, which isn't that often. Well, when I meet lots of other musicians, it tends to be at festivals and things like that, and quite famous people will sidle up to me, you know, and sort of say, by the way, you know, I really like so-and-so. And then they sort of sidle off again, you know, before I have a chance to shake their hand. So I don't really give it much thought because I can't really believe it happens that much. But every so often, as you say, like with Alex, it comes about. It's very nice, too, when it does.
That's St. Louis Public Radio's Mike Schran talking with musician Nick Lowe. Lowe performs next Wednesday, September 26th, 8 p.m. at the Sheldon Concert Hall as part of the Sheldon Sessions series. Here's a song from his latest album, The Old Magic.
I'm 61 years old now. Lord, I never thought I'd see 30. Though I know this road is still some way to go, I can't help thinking on, will I be beloved and celebrated for my masterly climb? Or just another bum when it comes to checkout time? I'm fearful my chances of crossing over Jordan in